The county's number one talk show, the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio.
Very good morning to you. This is the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio with Donal Kavanagh standing in for Greg for today. You're very welcome along. A packed show as always. It's the first show of the week. It's Monday morning. It's the 12th of February and we want to hear what you have to say about the issues of the day. You can call us on 0749125000 0035374 9125000 if you're outside of the dialing area. We have Caroline Orr producing and Caroline and Shannon taking your calls as well. You can text us, of course, 086 60 25000. That number good for WhatsApp messages as well. And of course we are on the various socials. We're at Highland Radio on X, we're Highland Hub on Facebook, and we're also available on YouTube, where we're streaming live, of course, on our channel Highland Radio Ireland. You can see the live feed on our Facebook pages as well. So plenty of opportunity to engage with the show. And as we always say, your views, your perspectives on the day's events and the things important to you are the things that are important to us. So please let us know what you'd like to talk about this morning. Starting with the papers, as we always do, and the Monday edition of the Donegal News. Measles warning, Donegal is at particular risk. And you'll recall hearing on the show last week, Greg speaking to Dr. Anthony Breslin, the public health specialist in this region. And he was making it quite clear that the measles situation is worrying in Donegal because they look for a vaccination rate of about 95% in order to declare an area reasonably safe. And Donegal is closer to 84-85%, so a little bit below the targets there in terms of vaccinations. So measles, an issue. Spend on community agency staff rose in 2023. There was a 23% rise in the amount of money the HSE spent on agency staff in community healthcare across Cavan, Donegal, Leitrim, Monaghan and Sligo, according to figures that were provided to the paper. And a nice picture there of Bishop Alan McGuckian with Margaret Coyle and Noreen Sharkey. Bishop McGuckian at the 8th birthday of Letterkenny Park Run, and anyone that does the park run will know that Bishop McGuckian is a very enthusiastic runner and has been doing the park run and has done the 10K, and you'll have seen him walking and running on many occasions around the streets. And sadly, it'll be one of the last park runs he does because he's bound for Belfast, as we know. Moving on to the Derry News. Man critical after serious road traffic collision. Strand Road in the early hours of yesterday morning. A man was hit by a car and brought to hospital. Detectives investigating say that the collision involved a pedestrian and a black Volkswagen Golf, and they're looking for anyone with information to come forward and help them on that particular one. Irish Independent this morning. Housing crisis forces coalition into plea to Irish builders abroad. Irish construction workers living abroad are going to be encouraged back home to help address the housing crisis under a new government plan. Higher Education Minister Simon Harris has been given €750,000 to launch the campaign to entice builders back. You'd indeed have heard Minister Harris on the news there with Donna Marie just a few moments ago. Also looking, of course, to build more higher education links with Irish people abroad. Something, in fairness, Donegal County Council has been doing for quite some time, actually, in terms of its diaspora focus. And we know over the years, particularly at the Golden Bridges event in Boston every year, Donegal County Council, and indeed what was LYIT, went over every year, and a number of very important linkages forged with that particular one. And that's a model now that's being pursued by Minister Harris over in the US and looking at Australia as well. And we know in this county that goes double, of course, because there's so much work to be done in terms of defective blocks and the remediation and the demolition and the rebuilding of homes affected in that particular crisis. So, you know, a real need for more construction people to come over, and this is going to be a very interesting and potentially a very important initiative. Irish Times this morning. Biden warns Israel over Rafah offensive, and very disturbing indications coming that Israel is about to make a very strong move on Rafah in the coming days. Already bombardments overnight. We're hearing of tens of people killed in those particular bombardments. And Rafah is the place, of course, that had been declared by Israel a safe zone. And effectively, Palestinians were told, go south, go south, go south, go to Rafah, you'll be safe. Go to Rafah, you'll be safe. Now, effectively, they're being promised safe passage out of Rafah. But where are they supposed to go? And that's the one thing that no one really seems to know. And Israel, however, insistent that it's going to keep up its its offensive. And Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister yesterday, absolutely bullish about the whole thing. Gardaí to interview woman about death of child. You've heard that tragic story on the news with Donna Marie there as well. Gardaí investigating the death of 6-year-old Matthew Healy near Dunmore East in Waterford, hoping to interview a suspect today. And key departments clash over refugees' housing. Official says serious risk of people going from direct provision to homelessness. And it's the age-old problem. We get a commitment that we're going to replace direct provision, and that's being followed through. But the problem is, when you replace something like direct provision, what contingency plan do you have to actually replace it? And it seems the contingency is take your chance. There is a huge housing crisis in the area of asylum seekers, of those seeking international protection, and the refugees as well coming over from Ukraine, and there is a serious situation. We all know that, and it all feeds in as well to the appeal for builders that we referenced earlier, that we just do not have enough housing available. It doesn't seem that long ago that we were sitting here talking about ghost estates because there were too many houses available, but a lot has changed in about 10-12 years. Irish Daily Mail this morning: 200,000 hospital cancellations in just 9 months, including 650 treatments for children's chemo. The appointments were cancelled over the first 9 months of 2023. Their figures are revealed in the Irish Mail today. They show that 196,729 operations cancelled. The cancellations increased by over 50%. And there's more inside. Also, rural TDs unite for general election. The Independent Party have secured TD Michael Fitzmaurice as a candidate for the next general election. They're seeking to capitalise on the rural vote. Mr. Fitzmaurice said, "It's all about common sense. We're all thinking in the same way." And there's more on the inside of the paper. Also, Michael Collins and Richard O'Donoghue are both involved in the this new party as well. And it's going to be an interesting election coming up, whenever it may be it October or be it earlier. It has to be before February of next year. But the thought process does appear to be that they are going to go earlier rather than wait until February. So October, September, October, probably the most likely time. But we'll see what happens. Moving on to the Red Tops, Irish Daily Star this morning: "Fight, said Fred. Infamous mobster Fat Freddie Thompson is set to appear in court over a series of alleged attacks on prison officers. The Kinahan cartel killer has now amassed dozens of disciplinary charges while behind bars," we're told, excuse me, by the Irish Daily Star. Irish Daily Mirror this morning: "New York gives the green light to Gardaí. Officers will be allowed to march on St. Patrick's Day." There was a bit of a standoff, it seems, over a couple of days toward the end of last week, when Gardaí hadn't been invited to march in the St. Patrick's Day parade. Apparently there was some suggestion that there was a problem last year with the way they lined up or something. I didn't read into the full thing, to be perfectly honest with you. It comes after officers were told last week they wouldn't be able to take part in their uniforms as they hadn't been invited. But that does seem to be resolved. The Irish Sun this morning: "Tubbs was pilloried. He had to leave RTE." Pat Kenny exclusive. Pat Kenny says RTE made it virtually impossible for Ryan Tubridy to work there again. Tubridy, 50, eventually left for Virgin Radio in the UK after last year's payments scandal at Montrose. News Talk host Pat, 76, who draws in 216,000 listeners on weekdays, told the Irish Sun where was he to go. They had pilloried him. Just looking at a couple of messages that have been handing over. Someone's saying, "I'm receiving a lot of calls and emails from the HSC. It's clearly a scam, including things like, can you please complete the attached form and send it back to me?" A lot of these scams are coming through, and I've said this before when I've done the programme. If at any point you get a text and you're thinking to yourself, what's all that about? It is a scam, probably. We've had numerous ones. I tend to get the eFlow one for some strange reason. And my wife actually got one recently, and it perturbed her, because we do actually use the M50. We do actually go through the M50 quite a bit, because we'd be travelling down south. And she would do some work in Dublin from time to time that involves, again, going down the M50 and through the toll there. So we actually do use it. And there was one time I almost fell for it, because we literally got the message an evening that we had gone through the toll. Now, the only thing is, we have one of those deals with eFlow whereby the camera reads our reg and it takes the money out of an account automatically. So we have that sort of video recognition account with them. So it's done. And that's what we do. But no, it's always, I would always say, if you see something come through on your on a text or an email, and if it looks suspicious, and if it looks like a rat and smells like a rat, then, you know, do you know what? It's a rat. Rondock's job losses. Quarter said just this week, 10 new hires were waiting in reception on their first day at work at a company in Donegal. But at 9, a call came through from head office asking for them to be sent home. They were told they were no longer needed and there was no job for them anymore. Some had left jobs in other places. One person actually moved home from Dublin, paid deposit on accommodation and bought a car to get to work, and questions raised over the way people were treated there. And we'll have more comments in just a moment. But now we're going to go to a very important call, and a call I've been looking forward to today, because over the weekend, the Donegal Person of the Year for 2023 was named. And I'm delighted to say that we're joined by the Donegal 2023 Person of the Year on the line. Moya Brennan, congratulations, and you're very welcome.
Thank you so much, Donal. Thank you. I'm thrilled.
Yeah, I have to be honest, my initial thought when I heard you'd been nominated were, has she not had that award already? Because I would have assumed you would have had that years ago.
Well, it was really funny. Some people said that to me the other night, but no, I've never had it. So I was very, very honoured. Excuse me, I have a bit of a cold at the moment. So, I was really honoured to be given such an accolade, because it's a big thing, you know, it's a real, you know, being respected from your own county, from your own area is huge.
You've been, I mean, and it's fair to say you have been a global superstar for decades, and there's very few major arenas on this earth that you haven't played, I suspect. But you've always carried Donegal with you. You've always carried home with you. There was never any doubt that wherever she was, wherever she lived, Moya Brennan was a Donegal woman through and through.
Oh, I'd like to think that very, very much so. I'm very proud to be Donegal. And you're right, anywhere I've gone, I'd mention Donegal off the stage or meet Donegal people afterwards, or, you know, whenever I talked to other journalists or anybody else in that country or wherever I was. It was always Donegal for me. And you know, it is the same for anybody that travels, you know. You don't kind of realise how important your county is till you kind of travel and you kind of say, wow, you know, I'm proud to be. Well, that's me anyway, you know. And so the more I travelled, the more Donegal I was, you know.
I was lucky enough to be in Millennium Forum just over a year ago when Clonard played their last gig in the Northwest as part of that farewell tour. And it was a staggeringly good gig, I do have to say. And I must say, I have said this directly to Aisling when I met her, but I have to say Aisling's take on In a Lifetime was absolutely magnificent between the two of you. It was absolutely brilliant, I have to say.
But wasn't it just? Yeah,
it was amazing. But I found that gig in the Forum, that was as intimate to me as a gig in a bar. I didn't feel like I was in a 1,000-seater theatre. I actually felt I was in a bar with friends at a session. And I think that's a vibe that you and the rest of the band managed to get across right across your career. And I think that's one of the things that made you special.
Well, it's nice that you felt that, because we actually felt that on the whole tour. You know, when we decided to do that, it was kind of very much in the offing of, you know, come and just watch us for the last time and enjoy where we come from, what we're about. And, you know, on that tour, we wanted to take you on a journey, and we wanted to kind of show you where we kind of started off with the earlier songs to kind of, you know, the Inner Lifetimes and the Robin O'Sherwoods. And, you know, it's been an amazing journey, because we're a young band from Donegal that started to play in my father's pub, and not in our wildest dreams. You know what I mean? Mm. Did you ever think that you'd win such accolades as Grammys and BAFTAs and Ivor Novellas and things like that? You know, it's like a dream, really. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was lovely to be able to put it all to bed in a way of saying this is our last touring together.
Yeah.
Because two have passed away now. And it was lovely that Ashley and Paul were able to be with me on stage. It meant a lot to me, and they were absolutely amazing. But you know, I've received loads of accolades or whatever, but people that have received Grammys and whatever, Ivor Novello Awards or whatever, haven't received a Donegal Best Person of the Year. So,
Maya, I don't want to keep you too long because obviously from the sound of your voice, you are suffering. And listen, I really appreciate the fact that you have spoken to us this morning.
Yeah, no, it's okay.
I also want to acknowledge, actually, I'm involved with Relay for Life. And every year you're available, you've come and you've played for us. And many people would have seen you on stage during the Luminaria.
Well, we tried to, yeah.
And I have the honour of narrating it. So I've been on stage with you a number of times during Luminaria. And it's wonderful to have you there. And yeah. I just want to acknowledge that you've always had that interest in local charity as well. You've always been very supportive of things like Relay and other charities right across Donegal. And for that, I think a lot of people would recognise you for that too. So, Moya, I won't detain you any longer.
That's great.
Get well soon, because I know you're back on the road in March, aren't you, on a solo tour? So,
yes, England with Cormac DeBarra and myself and just my own band and, you know. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
And we look forward to seeing one of those shows down the line. Moya, congratulations on the accolade. Well deserved. And we wish you all the best into the future.
Thank you.
And may you have a wonderful night in Dublin in the Bonington in April.
Thank you so much, Dawn. Very much so. Thank you.
A pleasure, Moya. Thank you indeed. And congratulations again. That's Moya Brennan, who was named Donegal Person of the Year for 2023. That was announced in Crísla. And as you know, of course, the people of Crísla held the accolade of Donegal Person of the Year jointly over the past year because of the response to the tragedy of October 2002. So from that point of view, it was very... poignant that the announcement was made in Crísla, and Crísla, obviously Moya just from down the road in Guador, Crísla in area, I'm sure she knows very well indeed. We're going to change tack. We're going to move on to a different issue completely, because Saoirse Brady of the Irish Penal Reform Trust joins us on Zoom. She's the executive director of that body. Almost 9 in 10 Irish employers who took part in research commissioned by the Irish Penal Reform Trust agreed they would consider hiring someone with a history of convictions. However, barriers remain for employers and potential employees with previous convictions, according to the Reform Trust. And we're going to pick through some of the findings of that report now with Saoirse. Saoirse, good morning. Saoirse, good morning. Okay, I think... Hang on, I may have muted myself. Right, somehow I managed to mute myself. Saoirse, I do apologise. Good morning.
Well, no worries. I thought it was on my hand.
No, it isn't. And to be honest, usually I was there going, and then I just noticed I have somehow managed to mute myself, which, hey, I have a talent for doing things nobody else would do. Saoirse, you're very welcome. The research that was commissioned found that, you know, almost 90% of employers would consider hiring someone with a previous conviction, but there are barriers, there are ifs, there are buts. And one of the things and one of the challenges that you're facing now is to sort of tease through those buts and tease through those ifs, whats and maybes and try and get to the nub of the issue. What are the main problems?
I suppose this was a small scope in the study. We got funding from the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission to commission this study. So we had two researchers from Maynooth University actually carry out this research for us. And they carried out interviews with both employers and people with a history of conviction. They did some interviews with them, and then they brought lots of people together in a symposium and teased out some of the problems. But really, I suppose what we found was, as you said, you know, 9 out of 10 employers said they would hire somebody with convictions. And the barriers that they found weren't around, for example, the things that you might expect, that they didn't think the person would turn up on time, that there'd be absenteeism, all of those things. It was actually that they felt that, well, it was the type of offence, they did consider risk. And then it was the lack of support. That was the biggest thing coming from employers, that they didn't want to put a foot wrong. They know that people who may have served time in prison or done community service, you know, they've served their sentence, but at the same time, you know, they may also have complexities in their life. So they didn't want to exacerbate that in any way. So what they're crying out for are state supports, and not in terms of finances, but like an information line that they can phone to say, look, you know, am I doing the right thing? They want guidance on the types of policies that have to put in place. So half the employers that the researchers spoke to, only half of them had a policy around when you disclose a conviction during the recruitment process, if you have to tell other staff or not. And obviously, you know, I think we all know about data protection these days. So that came up as a real concern as well.
From your own point of view, looking into this issue, there is always going to be a risk of reoffending. And I would presume that one of the ways to prevent reoffending is for the person to actually get a job and to earn money and to find their place in society. And the longer it takes to get a job and the longer it takes to re-enter society in that respect, the more there is a risk of reoffending. Have you done any studies or any looks to see, is there a correlation between, you know, getting a job and maybe being less inclined to reoffend?
Yeah, no, that came out from some of the people who had offended in the past. You know, when they came out of prison, they really tried to get a job. And when they were hit with these barriers, they didn't know when they had to tell people, or, you know, when they applied for a job, they would tell people, yes, I have a conviction. And then they felt they were back to square one. But we know the things that help people stop reoffending. You know, they're keeping links with family. They're making sure you've got a roof over your head if you come out of prison. It's maybe not going to prison in the first place if it's a less serious offence. But work and employment is a huge part of this. Like, we all know that a job really gives you a sense of yourself. And I suppose what this study did as well was not just look at, you know, OK, somebody comes out of prison or they have served a sentence in the community and that they should just take any job. What really came out of this was looking at people not just having a job, but decent work, access to decent work, and looking at a career path as well. And we know from some people who've turned their lives around and have been incredibly successful that that is possible. But we know that they also need the support to do that. And, you know, I suppose what came out of this study as well were people talking about those, you know, small things that an employer did that were really important to them, you know, where they built them up, they gave them confidence, they, you know, said it didn't matter, that they were going to give them a chance and let them move on with their lives.
Is there sufficient support in prison to prepare those about to be released or being released in the next while for work and for re-entering into society? Because there must be difficulties there in terms of how do you approach an interview? How do you bring this up? How do you raise this? Do you put it on a CV? I mean, there must be, and as you said, there's a whole minefield now of GDPR and people don't necessarily have the right to pry into your past or to, you know, to investigate you. But do you have an obligation? I mean, there's a lot of questions and I'm sure it needs a lot of teasing out. Is there sufficient support given, particularly to those about to leave prison in terms of preparing for this?
So there are supports in place for some people, you know, so when you go to prison, you may have access to education and training. So, you know, we know there are some really good programs being run, say, in the Midlands prison around retrofitting, because obviously there's a crying out for retrofitting for houses, for example. So, you know, people are upskilling on that. But I suppose part of the problem is at the moment, we have a huge overcrowding issue in prisons, and that puts a huge strain on staff, on prison staff, and it also means that some of that education isn't happening because, you know, if there are so many people in prison, if there are court appearances that prison officers have to escort them to, the first thing that usually falls off are the schools have to close. So then you're not having that access. You know, people in prison do have access to sentence management. They should have a plan in place. We know there are organisations like IASIO who are supporting people to reintegrate once they leave prison and putting those supports in place. But because of the huge numbers in the prison system at the moment, and we would say that not everybody in there needs to be in there, that is putting pressure on all of those things. So this is all going to have a ripple effect and a knock-on effect. So what we really need to do, there is government policy to reduce the number of people going to prison on short-term sentences and maybe serve a sentence in the community. And if they happen to be in work, they would be able to retain that job, hopefully. So we would like them to implement that reduction in the number of people going to prison. There's a huge number of people in prison on remand, so it means they may never have been sentenced yet. Could they be out on bail, you know, for example? So I think there are other solutions to this, but you're right. I think we do need to make sure the people in prison are properly prepared for the outside, because what we hear time and time again is people leave the prison gate with a plastic bag with all their belongings in it. They look left or right and they don't always know where to go. And very often they don't have somewhere to go to put their head for the night. So they end up in homeless accommodation. So the housing crisis has put pressure on here as well. So we really need to think about all of this. Obviously, this study is focused on employment, but it can't happen in isolation. We know that you can get into employment if everything else in your life is stable, if you have the supports, if you need mental health supports, if you need addiction supports, if you need housing and accommodation. You need all of that as well as the chance to get back into employment.
What needs to be done from the government side? Does this require new legislation, or does this require funding commitments from presumably Minister McEntee and her department, or is it going to have to be a sort of a cross department, bringing in education, bringing in the other enterprise and employment as well, and getting all three departments talking to each other to try and make sure that the strategies are in place? Because it would seem in the longer term, the more you can successfully get people into employment after prison, the less chance there is that you're going to be welcoming them back in a couple of months or a couple of years' time.
All of the above. So what we would say is there are pieces of legislation that would really make a difference here. One of those is the equality legislation, so changing the Equality Status Act and the Equality Employment legislation to include criminal conviction as a ground for discrimination or anti-discrimination. You know, there is a review going on of the equality legislation at the moment. It is looking and exploring whether or not socioeconomic status will be included as a ground of a protected ground. And, you know, obviously that is very linked to the number of people that end up in prison. But we would say go a step further and have criminal conviction as an additional step as well. There's also spent convictions legislation. So this is where you don't have to disclose certain convictions after 7 years. So that would make a big difference. Senator Lynn Rowan has a piece of legislation waiting to go through. There is cross-party support for it. Even the minister said she would support it with some amendments. So we'd love to see that through in the lifetime of this government. And then the funding piece is the other big piece. The Department of Justice and Fairness is putting together a new employment strategy for people involved in the criminal justice system, and it will be out in a number of months. And we did have a representative from the Department of Justice speak at our launch last week, and he did say a lot of it aligned. So that's really heartening to hear. But I suppose the other piece is here, the Department of Enterprise, Trade and Employment need to lead by example. They need to have people with previous convictions as a target cohort for their strategies. And that support service that I mentioned that employers want, we need dedicated funding for that and an information campaign for both the public, people with convictions, so they know when they have to disclose or not disclose, when they can actually move on, and for employers. So we have 10 recommendations in the report. We made sure they were very tangible and practical. They do require some funding, but I wouldn't say it's huge amounts. And we need to see those start to be implemented in budget 2025.
The worry, of course, is the political reality is that we face local and European elections in June. Potentially we face a general election later this year. A lot of the optics and a lot of the work done by government parties inevitably in the coming months is going to be with an eye toward elections. And the big question is, are there going to be any votes in this? And the worry would be that if it isn't a vote getter, it's not going to be prioritised.
And you're right. And I think that's something that we really need to think about, because, like, as you said earlier, if people get back into employment, if they have security and stability, we know that they're less likely to reoffend. So let's look at this from a community safety point of view. If you give people the supports that are there, then actually there should be votes in it, because we know it results in safer communities. And that's what all the international evidence says. So that's what we've been banging the drum on that for quite a while. But we do keep reiterating that. We'd also say as well, people in prison can vote. And we would really encourage the political parties to engage with people in prison, particularly in the local and European. So there are people in prison who would have a right to vote in the locals and in the European elections. So we need to think about that as well. And then their families as well are on the outside. We need to encourage people to vote by ensuring that they know their loved ones will be supported to turn their lives around. So I think there are votes in it. It mightn't be the most popular voting issue out there, but I think there is a responsibility on all of those standing for election to engage with this particular cohort, because unless you do, things aren't going to change.
Saoirse Brady, Executive Director of the Irish Penal Reform Trust, thank you very much indeed for speaking to us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Saoirse. It has been our pleasure. It's the 9 till noon show on Highland Radio. Let's look at some of your comments. A caller says the people coming into our country not only unvetted but unvaccinated as well. But let's blame the Irish anyway. Anyone I know had an MMR. Now that's a reference, I presume, to the measles story that we covered on the newspapers earlier on. Then Cotter says, when Donal is on, comments are always deleted for some reason. Where are the sanctions on Biden and Britain for bombing and killing innocents? That's a question there. Still steadfast in their support for Israel at the moment. And Joe Biden, we're told, is sternly speaking to Benjamin Netanyahu. But certainly there's a lot of question marks over the implicit or explicit support that both Britain and the US are giving to Israel at the moment. Good morning to Annie Thady and good morning to Beth, both of whom are viewing us on our Facebook page at the moment. Thank you very much indeed for joining us today. A few of your comments. Cotter says, I'm recently divorced. I'm trying to find accommodation. Everywhere to rent is between 1,200 and 1,450 euro a month in the Letterkenny area, even 20 minutes outside Letterkenny. I'm staying with my mother. I can't afford anywhere. I work in Letterkenny. People don't realise how serious the situation is. Another caller says, I'm just wondering if anyone can help me out. I have a house that's fully dry lined and heat on every day with people living there full times, and clothes in the wardrobes are mouldy. Any help would be much appreciated, if you can give any perspective on that particular issue. Another caller says, no wonder the emergency department in Letterkenny is always full. It's almost impossible to get a GP appointment. Our GP closes their phone lines before 10 a.m, fully booked already. The medical centre answers the phone, but there isn't a doctor available to issue a regularly occurring prescription, despite the fact that they're aware I'm prone to pneumonia following lung damage from COVID a few years back. So instead, I have to contact NowDoc after hours when chemists are closed, pay them 50 or 60 euro and get enough antibiotics to last until the following week, then pay the medical centre 40 or 50 euro to have the regularly occurring prescription issued, something that's normally agreed with doctors during a 2-minute phone call based on my medical history. Welcome to healthcare in the Northwest. An under-resourced, not funny joke. I absolutely appreciate the difficulty you may have getting on to your GP, Cotter. And I have had the experience of on the phone going, repeat call, repeat call, repeat call, repeat call, repeat call, repeat call. And I have taken, at one point, it did take me 2 days to get through to a GP surgery, and it was to get a prescription refilled. I have to say, if they're charging 40 or 50 euro for to reissue a prescription, that is an awful lot of money, it seems to me. But absolutely, I feel that. And, you know, maybe what we need to be, can we get 6 monthly? I mean, I have a prescription and it's issued every 6 months or every month maybe, but maybe if we go for 1 month to 6 months, and if there has to be a blood test or whatever in the meantime, then fair enough, we can get that organised. But there may be, I think what's happened is the situation changed during COVID and we haven't yet fully sat back and looked at, in the post-COVID situation, how can we improve communications, how can we make things better in terms of things like repeat prescriptions, and how can we organise the emergency department better as well. And absolutely, anyone that has to go to the ED, it is a nightmare in there. There's no doubt about that, and that cannot be avoided. Now, one or two more comments before we go for a quick break. Caller says, I hear the government put out a tweet for Irish men to come back to Ireland and build houses for all the immigrants. Doesn't make much sense to me. Thought the migrants were jack of all trades and great for the country. Oh, well, I mean, I personally would believe that maybe what we do need to do is have a situation where if people are seeking international protection, that there is a facility open for them to go to work, particularly if they are builders. I mean, I think if people are living in the country and they have an ability to work, there should be a pathway through which they can work. Absolutely. Another person says, I was listening to a number of Irish people on the radio last week about not being able to afford vet fees for their dogs. They have to hand them to a charity to pay for them. I was horrified to read our government has spent €800,000 on refugees bringing their pets into Ireland. How can this be acceptable? Thank you. Now, I will be honest, I haven't particularly heard that figure mentioned, or I haven't seen that story. I'm not aware of it. A lot of people find emotional solace and find emotional stability in their pets. And for many people, a pet can be a very, very important part of their lives. And maybe the pets in question are serving the, we speak a lot about service dogs and animals who are support animals, and perhaps there's an element of that there as well. It's an issue, and thank you, caller, for bringing it to our attention. It's the 9 till noon show. It's 18 minutes to 10 o'clock. Going to take a short break. Back after these. A public meeting will take place tonight at 7 in the Galadlas Community Centre to discuss how the new Milford Community Centre gifted €200,000 by anonymous donors will be used. The huge donations will be used for the continued redevelopment of the former Reformed Presbyterian Church in Milford. Joined on the line by Declan Meehan, who is manager of the Milford and District Resource Centre. Declan, good morning.
Good morning, Donald.
Declan, to be gifted, I beg your pardon, to be gifted the former Reformed Presbyterian Church in itself was, I'm sure, a huge boost for Milford. For that to be followed up with a anonymous €200,000 donation for use in the community, you must have thought all your Christmases came at once.
Absolutely. I think it shows that positivity breeds positivity, and generosity kind of creates further generosity, which we're delighted with. As you say, we were very kindly gifted the building by the Reformed Presbyterian congregation in Milford in November 22. We've opened it partially as a community centre since September 2023, so just a few months ago. And since then, it's become a thriving hub in the community. And that has been followed up, as you say now, with €200,000 of a donation, which will allow us to hopefully leverage more grant funding, maybe further donations for a complete redevelopment of the building so that it becomes a community facility that's modern and fit for purpose and meets the needs of the community.
This comes at a time when you are trying to develop a community sense of in Milford. It's giving you an opportunity that will not come around again, presumably. So what you want to do is make sure that you get it right this time. And with that in mind, you're calling this public meeting tonight to make sure that the views of the community, the views of everybody with an interest in this, are taken on board.
Absolutely. Last year, we received a Heritage Council grant of €16,300, and that allowed us to carry out a conservation study, a feasibility study, and a public consultation at that stage. So we've already been engaging the community in every step of this process, and now as the feasibility study findings are to be presented this evening, along with obviously news of the €200,000 donation, we want to involve the community further about the planned development of the building and what that building hopefully will look like once that development is completed, and again how it's going to meet the needs of the community. So having people from the community come in to take part in that public meeting this evening is essential for us, because the building belongs to the people of Milford, and that's, you know, how it was gifted. MDRC, Milford and District Resource Centre, are simply caretakers of it on behalf of the community. So it's not my decision to make in terms of how the development goes. It's the whole community's decision.
Now, there is also the Town First plan for Milford, which is being drawn up at the moment as part of a government initiative. And indeed, Heather Humphreys, the Minister, announced more funding for town teams last week. And Milford, one of the, I think it's 21 or 22 towns across the country that is benefiting from that. So the two coming together, again, it increases the opportunity for something very special to happen in Milford. And those two working in tandem and in cooperation can really make a big difference.
Certainly, I think that the Town Centre First Plan was a huge opportunity for Milford. The finalised plan was published before Christmas, and we're seeing that the first kind of component of that plan will be published, which is the development of the lands at Mount Marion for the development of a town park. So a lot of exciting things happening in Milford. Community development is slow work, but over the past few years, a lot has happened in Milford, which we're delighted with.
as you say, it's slow work, but no doubt this €200,000 donation on top of the donation of the building will accelerate that somewhat and give you the opportunity, as we said earlier, to do something that's important, because not only do you have this money, but this now gives you the opportunity, as you say, to leverage other grant funding and you know, perhaps do something really, really special. In terms of the ideas, do you have any idea in your mind of what lies ahead, or do you want to keep your powder dry, as it were, until you hear from the people at this meeting tonight?
Yeah, I think that's very much, I suppose, the opinions of the people of the community are more important than mine alone. But I think that, you know, from our last public consultation, what was clear was that there was a real need for further community infrastructure in general in Milford. And that ties in with the Town Centre First Plan as well, in terms of the development of a town park, but also just simply to have a fit-for-purpose, a modern community centre that's open and accessible for everyone to use for whatever they want and need in the community. So whatever plan that comes out of this and whatever feedback we get from the community tonight, I think that we'll kind of be on the same track, on the same trajectory to develop exactly that.
In terms of that €200,000 donation, were there any conditions attached as to how it is to be used? Anything it can't be used for? Any specific requests or guidance included in the bequest of the money?
No, and I guess that's the best sort of donations you want to receive as a community organisation. The only condition was that it needed to be spent on the development of the building. The conservation study that we had conducted and commissioned last year, along with the feasibility study, will outline and do outline and prioritise a number of, I suppose, a scheme of works to take place on the building. So there, you know, there's no shortage of work that needs to be done on it. There's no shortage of projects associated with the building where money can be spent on. So, no, the only condition was that it be spent on the building and that the building obviously be for community use, which is obviously our primary concern and our primary aim.
Declan Meehan, manager of the Milford and District Resource Centre. That meeting takes place tonight in the Gallowglass Community Centre, which is the new name for the former Reformed Presbyterian Church building in Milford. The meeting's on tonight at 7. Some very, potentially very exciting times ahead. And Declan, we wish you all the best and look forward to seeing some really tangible benefits come to Milford and come to that community as a result of this money. But Declan, for the moment, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, look, that's Declan Meehan there, who is manager, as we say, of the Milford and District Resource Centre. And I'm sure anyone involved in community development would be only too delighted to get a donation like Declan and his colleagues in the centre have received. That meeting, if you want to make your views on what should be done known, meeting is on tonight at 7 in the centre. Number of callers. Caller says, are the poor prisoners, treat them like the law-abiding citizens? Why were they in prison to begin with? Well, they were in prison because they committed a crime and were convicted of that crime. Also, in the course of being in prison, they paid for that crime. They paid their debt to society. And now it is a question of what happens next. And that's what Saoirse and her colleagues in the Irish Penal Reform Trust were discussing. Caller says, Donal, I find it impossible to get an appointment in my medical centre. Since COVID, they're seeing little or no patients. I'm changing my GP because of this. Sorry to hear that, caller. I wish you all the best. I believe in some areas it can be very, very difficult you know, to even get a GP now if you don't have one. So we wish you luck in what you do. Another caller says, can anyone explain to me why we can no longer get an appointment on that day or the next day when you call a GP? You're lucky now if you get an appointment within 2 weeks. Another caller says, just wondering, when is the road going into the new Dunns in Letterkenny going to be fixed? It's becoming very bad. I travel on it every morning on my motorbike, so says a caller. Another number of callers, and this is an interesting one. Caller says, can anyone explain why pencils are used when marking a ballot paper? I can't sign an official paper in a pencil. Why is the most important document in society signed with pencil? If I use a pen, is my vote invalid? Also, 5 years is too long for a term of government. Is 3 years not enough? Can anyone explain the reason for a five-year term? First point first. My understanding is there is absolutely nothing wrong with bringing your own pen and using a pen in the polling booth. My take on it is I think, you know, pens can run out of ink, pens can blot. If you have a pen and if you blot your voting paper and a blot of ink goes across two sections and suddenly is your vote inadvertently spoiled by something that wasn't your choice. So a pencil gives more control. Also, a pencil isn't going to run out. And it may be from that point of view, it is as practical as that. My understanding is if you use a pen, your vote is absolutely not invalid. There is nothing wrong with bringing, and I know a number of people do bring their own pens. I've heard some suggestions that, you know, votes may be changed because the pencil can be rubbed out and an alternative mark put on. All I will say to that is that once the ballot box is sealed in by the presiding officers in the polling stations, those ballot boxes are under Garda control and supervision and are guarded by Gardaí until such a time as they are brought into the count centre, opened, and their contents are poured onto the table. I don't see where there would be any opportunity for anyone to interfere with or change or alter a vote because those boxes are under supervision and under scrutiny at all times. I would also suggest that the personation officers appointed by the political parties and the tally teams that the parties have in the count centres themselves, some of those are so used to covering elections and scrutinising ballot papers. My suspicion is that there are tally men and tally women in this county who would spot a paper that had been tampered with at 50 paces. There is no doubt in my mind that if a paper was, a vote was rubbed out and something was changed, it would be noticed, I strongly suspect. As for the 3 years versus five, the problem with 3 years would be what you then get is a permanent election campaign. I think the idea would be that 5 years gives a government time to actually implement policies, bring in legislation, implement that legislation. That's the theory. If you're every 3 years, you're having elections every 3 years, you're having... I don't know. I'll put that question out there if anyone has a comment to make. Another caller says, can I ask a question? There are people out canvassing and placing far-right leaflets in our door and they're approaching doors in large groups. My little boy lifted one of the leaflets and was quite afraid. What are our rights as property owners from stopping this? We've received 9 leaflets in the last 3 weeks. I haven't had any such leaflets put into my door. I'm not aware of it. Are the 9 leaflets all the same, or are they 9 different leaflets purporting to come from 9 different groups? What the law is with regards to cannabis, I mean, you can put a sign on your door that says no post no bills or no posters please or no flyers please. As to what the legal standing of a notice on your door like that is, I honestly do not know. It's a question certainly that we will put out there. And if anyone has a perspective on that question, you know, what rights do people have in terms of stopping the placing of election materials and, you know, leaflets and so on into their doors? Do people have any rights in terms of stopping that? Not that I'm aware of, but we'll certainly put the question and see.